Coming up on Tech News Weekly, a Chinese chip reportedly hacked onto the motherboard of 30 U.S. companies' products. Also, the discovery of an exomoon in orbit around an exoplanet evolves what we know about solar systems, and the SEC fallout targeting Tesla, all thanks to Elon Musk. All that and more coming up next on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 52, recorded Thursday, October 4th, 2018. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by DigitalOcean, the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications. Over 150,000 businesses rely on DigitalOcean to remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. Sign up today and receive a free $100 credit at do.co/TNW. And by LastPass, secure every password-protected entry point to your business. Join over 33,000 businesses and start managing and securing your company's passwords today. Learn more at lastpass.com/twit. Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is the show where we talk with people who are making and breaking the big tech stories of the week. I'm Jason Howell. No, outside of the camera shot here is not Megan Maroney. She is in the woods, I think, avoiding technology. At least that's what she told us. But apparently she's tweeting. So she's doing it behind the backs of camp counselors, wherever she happens to be. So try and pick that apart. Anyways, let's jump into our top story here. The big news this morning involves a report released by Bloomberg that illustrates how Chinese spies reportedly have hacked their way into the supply chain of nearly 30 U.S. companies. And let's just say that's bad news on any given day, but particularly bad news in this modern era where there's already this thick fog of hesitation and suspicion as relates to China and the U.S. Joining us to talk about this complicated story is Ian Thompson from The Register. Welcome back, Ian.
Well, thanks very much for having me. It's been an interesting morning, should we say that?
Yeah, it really has been. It's one of those stories that kind of exploded on the scene this morning, and everybody's been chattering about it. And it's really hard to know what's real and what's not. So the report by Bloomberg Businessweek talks of a tiny microchip, just absolutely tiny. There's a little picture of the thing on a finger that was supposedly inserted into motherboards created by Supermicro computers. How big is Supermicro, and what is the reach of this tainted hardware from there and outward into other computers' hardware?
Well, Supermicro is about as big as it gets, to be honest. I mean, when it comes to the amount of hardware they push out, it's huge. They've been certified by the U.S. government, so their systems can be used by the intelligence community. Businesses are very happy with them because they'll offer you hundreds of different configuration options for the hardware that you want, get it built, get it shipped out. And they're seen as a very sort of reliable and, no one ever got fired for buying Supermicro, at least not yet.
That yesterday and before, today and beyond, maybe a different story.
Not so much. Yeah.
So what about the payload here? This is a chip that supposedly during the supply chain was thrown onto these motherboards. There's got to be a reason for it if they do so, exist as Bloomberg says they do. What are they capable of?
Well, The actual chip itself, very, very small, about the size of a grain of rice, they're saying. But it's where it was positioned on the motherboard. Basically, it was accessing the baseband management systems. So, for example, on a server, you've got a BMC chip, which allows the operator of that server to remotely manage certain things without actually having to fire up or power down the server. So by inserting this in between that and the main server, you basically pwn the system completely. It's never going to be picked up by antivirus software. It's never going to be picked up by simple scanning. The only way you would pick it up is by physically examining the motherboard or by looking for suspicious network traffic coming from a particular server, which is very, very difficult to do. I mean, one of the things that the Bloomberg said is that this chip is so small that the only way you can actually find it is by literally taking the motherboard out and going over it with a fine-tooth comb, trying to find out exactly where it would be. But yeah, if you've actually got that installed in front of the BMC system, as far as security goes, it's game over. There is no security.
Wow. Wow. Okay. So Supermicro, everybody's releasing statements. We'll talk about each of these statements. Supermicro released their statement today. Of course, they're refuting the story, the accuracy of the story. Investors are have been hitting the company hard. Last I checked, which was like about an hour and a half ago, the company's lost 40% of its value since the story broke.
46% last time I checked.
Man. Yeah, I know it was right around 50%. So it's fluctuating, but no matter how you slice it, pretty bad for Supermicro. Do you think their statement is just damage control, or do you think, what do you think about that?
Well, you see, this has been the key argument in the newsroom all day because, okay, when something like this breaks, like when we broke the Intel Meltdown piece, we got very equivocal statements from Intel. They were briefing other people behind our back saying, oh, you can't trust the register. Yeah, this is all rubbish. But in this case, both Supermicro's case statement, Amazon's statement, and especially Apple's statement are totally unequivocal. Mm-hmm. You know, there is very few weasel words in there that they could use to get around. And that's what makes this, in a way, such a puzzling story. Because, you know, I know the Bloomberg journalists who've written this. They wouldn't put their name to it if they weren't sure it was true. But that said, the complete and absolute denial by Supermicro, Apple, and Amazon raises some serious questions because in issuing these statements, they will have had to have them checked by lawyers and for SEC compliance because they're all public companies. Now, if they're caught out, if these statements are untrue, as we've seen when Elon shot his mouth off last week, then, you know, the SEC is perfectly willing to fire people, leverage huge fines. So if they are lying, it's an enormous risk. I mean, it makes Ford's choices over the Pinto look like just of a, oh, whatever. You know, I mean, there are billions at stake on this one. So this is what makes, as I say, what makes it so unusual in that, you know, we wouldn't usually hear this level of firm statement from a company if there was any, if they weren't absolutely sure that they weren't, you know, that they were in the right on this one.
Yeah, I mean, that was my concern about this, too, is if they're all coming out so heavily against the details in the report. Let's just say that right now at this moment in time, there is a whole lot of one person saying 100% unequivocally it's this and another person or a company saying 100% unequivocally it's this. And it's not just in this story, it's in a whole other sort of ways that we're seeing this happening right now. Maybe it's a strategy that works, but there is the risk of this SEC, the risk of the SEC coming down on securities fraud with that, which would be, I mean, I couldn't see that as being a calculated risk that a company like Apple would be willing to take unless it was absolutely
or
confident.
Amazon. I mean,
or Amazon. Yeah, of course.
Yeah, the two largest companies, basically by dollar up by stock market value, pretty much in the world, would face huge financial penalties if they actually lied about this. And we've been going through those statements with a fine tooth comb, and there's not a lot of wiggle room in there. You know, barely more than a gnat's whisker. So I mean, it would be. Okay, I would say it's not inconceivable, but it would be incredibly foolish. And I know these days lying is seen as no big deal in some parts of government, but business usually takes it more seriously than that. And if you're outright lying to journalists, then, you know, that would be a very, very expensive thing to do. However, important caveat, if this story is true, and this has been going on for 3 years, basically, anybody who's used AWS over the last 3 years, anyone who's used Apple products over the last 3 years, and anyone who's bought from Supermicro over the last 3 years can't trust their machinery and will have to pull out and manually inspect motherboards. And that's going to lead to a massive financial cost to the companies involved as well. So, you know, if it's true, then they may have just decided, well, we're going to get hit anyway. We may as well lie and try and minimize the damages. But that seems to be a very, you know, suicidal one, let's say, way of going about it.
Yeah, I would question whether they would actually make that calculated move. But hey, I guess I don't run Apple or Amazon. Who am I to judge?
Well, I mean, I'm a cynic too, but I genuinely can't see Tim Cook doing something that stupid. He's not dumb. You know,
no, definitely not. It seems out of character. So then let's consider for a moment that it is true. I mean, the chip has been found, so we know the chip exists, right? So there's some legitimacy to this. It's just a question of whether Apple and Amazon knew about it ahead of time, right?
Well, I mean, there's some questions. If you look at the Bloomberg story itself, I don't think it's actually explicitly confirmed that the chip they picture is the one that was used in the attack. And certainly from the images we've got, I've come across a mechanical engineer who's saying, well, hang on, that's only got three ports and you need two for power and two for data. So it may just be that that was a mock-up of some kind. If the chip has been found, I can't see a situation where the US government wouldn't investigate this to the fullest possible thing, because they know about this. They're already scared about this. China produces 90% of the world's computers, 70% of the world's mobile phones. Having a hardware hack like this would be an enormous security concern. Yeah. I mean, let's not deny it. The US does this as well, if the Snowden archives are to be believed. But the NSA's preferred tactic is, if a suspect orders a computer, they'll then intercept it in transit, install their own kit on it, and then let it go. They don't go to the work on the manufacturer's end. If China is working on the manufacturing end, then you see, hardware hacks like this are great because they bypass all security things and they're very difficult to detect. But on the other hand, they do definitely leave a paper trail behind them. Yeah. Someone's got to physically put that chip on the board, and there will be a record of that somewhere down the line. So it's also quite, you know, not too hard to actually attribute the attack to an individual or a particular subcontractor. Now, Bloomberg is saying that, you know, they've identified three or four subcontractors of Supermicro where they say these chips came from. But I don't know. There's something about this which is deeply, deeply disturbing, in that you'd have to spam out an awful lot of these chips and monitor all these chips just to get to a useful server, and not, you know, so an AWS server that's just doing some coders' GitHub projects. So, you know, if true, it's massive. But it would take a massive coordinated campaign by the Chinese. Now, the thing of what we have learned about the Chinese government over the last 20 or 30 years is that they're willing to undertake large-scale operations with a long-term payoff. So, you know, as always with these things, I'd like to see some more evidence. But at the moment, it's looking as though, you know, if true, then this is basically going to lead to huge numbers of companies having to rip and replace motherboards. If untrue, then two journalists have just ruined their professional careers.
Yeah. Either way, not good. And either way, we will find out, I'm sure, because, like, sooner rather than later, because you better believe the folks, you know, at the big companies whose names are on the line, if this isn't true, are going to be very, you know, at the front of this to squash it as fast as possible. So.
But also law enforcement and the government. I mean, Apple went so far as to say that they were not operating under a gagging order. They hadn't gone to the FBI and other agencies, which, you know, if this was the case, wouldn't be, they wouldn't say that, because that is easily refutable by the government.
Yeah.
So this is what has us scratching our heads about this one. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's a great story, but it could be that people have gotten to the end of the wrong end of the stick, or it could be that we're looking at one of the biggest cover-ups in recent decades.
Yeah, no kidding. Ian Thompson, always great to get you on, man. Thank you so much for taking some time to talk to us about this story and kind of clarify it a little bit. I really appreciate it.
Always fun, Jason. See you soon.
Theregister.co.uk to follow all of Ian's work there. Thanks again, Ian. Up next, a few big science-y stories along with Dr. Kiki. She's returning to the show. Always love having her on. But first, let's take a moment to thank the sponsor of this episode, which is DigitalOcean. DigitalOcean provides the easiest cloud platform to deploy, manage, and scale applications with droplets, virtual machines, that are scalable compute platform with add-on storage, security, and monitoring capabilities. You can choose from standard or CPU optimized droplets and customize from there. DigitalOcean is designed specifically for developers. They have an easy-to-use control panel and API that lets developers spend more time coding and less time managing their infrastructure. Industry-leading price to performance. You can access the compute resources that you need at the lowest rates, saving up to 55% compared to other cloud providers. And you'll always know what you'll pay per month because DigitalOcean has a flat pricing structure across all data center regions. Not only that, you get a bunch of stuff at no additional cost. You get 99.99% uptime SLA, cloud firewalls, monitoring and alerting, full DNS management, global data centers, enterprise SSDs, has an easy-to-use API. Over 150,000 businesses, including some of the world's fastest-growing startups, rely on DigitalOcean, and that's because they can remove infrastructure friction and deliver industry-leading price performance. So you can check it out and sign up today. You'll receive a free $100 credit by going to do.co/TNW. That's do.co/TNW, and you'll get a free $100 credit when you do so. And we thank DigitalOcean for their support of Tech News Weekly. All right, so there were a number of intriguing science-y stories this week. So who do we turn to when we want to talk all about the science? None other than the host of This Week in Science, Dr. Kiki. Welcome back.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me back to talk about science. Great to
Always.
Be here.
It's so great to see you again. So let's start with the big news from earlier in the week regarding the Nobel Prize and physicist Donna Strickland, the third woman to ever win the Nobel Prize in physics. Why don't we start by just kind of talking a little bit about her background? Tell us a little bit about her.
Well, Donna Strickland, she did this. She got this Nobel Award for her PhD work in Canada, and she is a laser physicist, works in very applicable science, and she's been rejected for Wikipedia entries because she wasn't quote-unquote famous enough.
Yeah, what's that all about? That doesn't even make any sense. Like, I think Nobel Prize kind of qualifies you.
Absolutely. And it sounds as though she's just a wonderful scientist and a human being and a great representative for science. Her paper that was published on laser physics, creating very high frequency laser pulses that are currently used today in eye surgeries. So they've gone all the way from the lab to helping people see better. Her original paper was, quote unquote, something of a scientific mic drop. In fact, there was no waffling about what she had done. Her paper was straight to the point, and there, you know, it was a very groundbreaking work.
And this is all, you know, all has to do with lasers. I think I saw like using lasers like as tweezers. Like, what are we talking about? Like, what is the actual application of what she was engineering here?
Yeah. So the award is shared between three different physicists, and a different physicist got an award for his work in creating optical tweezers, basically using the physical pressure of light to hold things like cells and atoms in place. And Dr. Strickland's work is on the power and the frequency of lasers. So taking the wavelength of light and spreading it out and then squishing it, you know, amplifying it and making the pulse of a laser actually much faster, much higher frequency. So the number of times the light goes up and down in a sine wave in a set amount of space, much higher, and increasing the power. And I guess you could analogize it to the sharpness of the laser. So basically making lasers sharper tools.
Nice. Freaking laser beams.
Freaking laser beams. That's right. Pew, pew, pew. Even though they don't make that sound. I really want them to.
But whoever makes them make that sound, I smell another Nobel Prize coming
up. Right.
Just saying. Right. Everybody knows what to work towards. Let's maybe talk a little bit about space. Space is always a lot of fun. Talk about some new research that might affect how us puny humans might make the ambitious trek out to Mars someday or possibly beyond. Apparently, galactic cosmic radiation is shown to be, you know, not very good for our organs. What's this all about?
Yeah, we've known that cosmic radiation, microwaves, X-rays, all of this electromagnetic frequency spectrum that's around us isn't great for us. And researchers have been trying to work on ways to shield researchers. But one of the questions is, if we were to go on further trips into space, if we were to put astronauts on long trips to Mars or even further out in the solar system and beyond, what would those long-term trips do to them if they didn't have the appropriate shielding on the ship or medications to deal with the radiation poisoning? And so researchers at, I believe it was Georgetown University Medical Center. They used a NASA facility that works on radiation, and they irradiated mice with heavy iron, iron-based rays, basically high-energy particle beams of iron, atoms at very high speed. And then they had another group of mice that were irradiated with X-rays and another group of mice that were control mice. They found that especially in the gastrointestinal tract, the damage was severe in the mice who were irradiated with these beams that were analogous to what cosmic rays would do in space. And they found that the cells in the intestine that turn over and are regularly dividing and creating the new surface, the sensitive surface of our epithelia inside of our gut, they get damaged. There's DNA damage leading to potential for cancer. The cells, many of them become senescent, which means that a lot of them stop dividing and die off. And this leads to could lead to gastrointestinal problems. And it's not only the gut, though. Anywhere there are dividing cells in the body, this is a problem. The high energy cosmic rays could affect those cells in a very negative manner. It's kind of like chemo radiation. You know, when you have cancer and you go in for chemo, it a lot of times kills the dividing cells. And you think about all the terrible things that people go through, the side effects that occur as a result of those dividing cells dying. You lose your hair, you have gut problems. There's all sorts of brain issues. That is what's going to happen to our astronauts unless we do something.
So obviously they need to identify what can happen. And in this case, they've done this with rats, right? And then that translates
with
over
mice.
With mice.
Yeah.
Sorry, not rats.
Yes.
So they know that there is some sort of effect, and they do this because then they can figure out ways around that. And you mentioned medication. I mean, I know, you know, there are a number of ways. It's not just our organs. It's, you know, there are a number of ways that this deep space travel, you know, accelerated aging, brain tissue, negative effects on brain tissue. Like, it sounds like there's so many forces that make this not a very good idea, let's say. But do they have ways to work around this effectively? Are they optimistic?
I mean, scientists are always optimistic because we're trying, you know, researchers are trying to figure out ways around things. But at this point in time, we do not have shielding on spacecraft that is suitable or sufficient to block cosmic rays. And so as of now, no, we don't have a way to fix it. We don't have medications either that could undo the damage that has been done. We have little stop gaps, but nothing that would really be appropriate.
We know what Elon Musk needs to work towards.
That's
next.
Right, Elon. If you want us to go to Mars, if you want SpaceX to take us to Mars, fix that shielding issue. Come up with some medications. Put some research money in there.
No big deal. That should be easy for you, Elon. You don't have anything else to do, right?
That's right.
Except stay out of trouble. Do that. Okay.
He's having a hard time with that these days.
He is. We're actually going to talk more about Elon a little bit later in the show, but I want to stick in space just a little while longer here, firmly in the depths of space. There's the new discovery that for the first time that shows a moon orbiting around exoplanets. So before we dive into these exoplanets, exomoons, whatever you want to call them, what exactly is an exoplanet and why are they so significant?
Right. Exoplanets are planets outside of our solar system.
Sounds planets pretty significant. Around,
pretty significant. So planets orbiting stars elsewhere in the universe. Mm-hmm. And we have been looking for them for several years. And we use a technique called transit. We look for changes in light. So basically, if you had a flashlight and it was shining a light and then, you know, put your hand in front of it, that flashlight, you'd see a dimming of the light. And so researchers are using craft like the Kepler mission to look for dimming light around stars. Basically, are these lights dimming from, you know, thousands of light years away? Are these little lights in the sky, are they having a transient little dip in the amount of light they emit? And if they do, that's indicative of a star with a planet around it,
rotating around it, and every time that planet passes in front, that would be the dip in light.
Yes.
kind of the idea there. Okay. So how many exoplanets have scientists discovered to date? It sounds like we've seen a lot of these, but we've never seen one with a moon rotating around an exoplanet.
Exactly. So we have seen over 2,000 exoplanets thanks to the Kepler mission. And we are now going to be finding even more closer to home thanks to a new mission that is up in the skies looking for exoplanets within about 30 to 300 light years away from us. So maybe we'll find alien life close to home. I don't know. But we have been looking for these exoplanets. We've found over 2,000 of them using the Kepler mission. And we have never before found a planet with a moon orbiting around it. I mean, think about the light signals. We're looking at light from thousands of light years away that has traveled to us from a star, looking for a single dip in that light that may indicate a planet, and then looking for additional wobbles in that light that has dipped to indicate that there is a moon around a planet around that star.
Wow. scientists are patient.
Very patient. And so Kepler found one signal. Researchers have been looking for this moon, exomoon signal for years through the Kepler data. They found a signal and they set Hubble on it. And they had Hubble observe this planet. And Hubble confirmed that there's a weird wobble in the light. And so the wobble, this weird discrepancy in the light signal, they believe is an exomoon. Now, being over 8,000 light years away around the star, this planet is a giant Jupiter. Like, it's massive, 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 massive. The moon that's orbiting this massive gas giant is the size of Neptune, which is a giant gas giant in our solar system. So for scale's sake, it's mind-boggling that a Neptune-sized moon is orbiting a giant planet around this star. And probably the only reason we've seen it is because everything is so big.
Right. That's exactly what I was going to say. If it was any smaller, we probably would have never seen it. Although scientists are smart, a whole lot smarter than me. And like I said, they're very patient. So it's awesome that they can have this ongoing pursuit. And then when you finally find that thing you spent your professional career looking for, that's got to feel really good. I can't even imagine.
It's got to be amazing for those researchers. I mean, using your whole career to look for exomoons and finally having the data coming together to allow you to see it. And these researchers, you know, they're really looking at other stars to try and figure out how our own solar system came into existence. We have an idea. There are multiple hypotheses about how solar systems form. We have, you know, a general idea. We look at Saturn as one possible example of how the solar system would form from a disk of dust and gas. And this is what we've seen so far, this one example in our own solar system. But now we have exoplanets to be able to confirm our ideas and hypotheses. And the interesting thing about having a Neptune-sized moon around a big giant gas giant is that it's likely not from this normal accumulation of dust and gas kind of material creating this happening. It's most likely that Neptune-sized moon was a planet and it got captured by the massive gravitational field of this massive gas giant. And that's what you're seeing.
Wow. Blowing my mind. Dr. Kiki, I love bringing you on because I learned so much, and then I realized how awesome you are talking about this stuff, because I could never explain it the way you do. You're so good at what you do. This Week in Science, TWIS.org, to check out your show. I know you're going to talk about some of these topics on your next episode, right?
That's right. The episode that we have coming out this week, we are talking about the Nobel Prizes. We are talking about this exomoon and many other wonderful science stories. There's a lot of fun this week. Right. TWIS.org.
There you go, Dr. Kiki. Thank you so much. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Jason. Have a wonderful afternoon.
I will. You too. Take care. Enjoy your science.
Bye. Tell Megan I say hi.
I will. I'll let her know when she returns from the woods, where she happens to be right now. No kidding. Coming up, autonomous car news aplenty. We've got Sam Abu El-Samid joining us once again. But first, Let's take a moment to thank the sponsor of this episode, and that is LastPass. I'm a huge fan of LastPass. I've been using LastPass for quite a while now. And LastPass has LastPass Enterprise for businesses. If you run a business and you want to make sure that password sharing and management for your employees is at the top level, that you're keeping that access data secure, you want to make sure that it's all secure. These are your passwords, your company-wide passwords, and you want to make sure that doesn't fall into the wrong hands. So LastPass Enterprise allows you to do that. You can share while keeping that data secure. It even allows for full customization of access, including the ability to set master password requirements, enable password resets, restrict access when needed. You can configure over 100 policies, access security reports, and create shared folders. You can also organize database logins, SSH keys, software licenses, and business information. And you can further protect your business with a multi-factor authentication. Highly recommend that you do that. With the LastPass Authenticator app, a verification button actually pops up on an employee's phone, makes it really easy to guarantee that they are the only ones with access to their accounts. If credentials happen to be compromised, the app ensures outsiders will not have access. The LastPass password generator makes it easy to use random, unique passwords that employees don't have to remember or to write down. Employees can log into LastPass with their Microsoft Active Directory credentials, so they truly only have one password to remember. Data is, of course, encrypted and decrypted at the device level. Data is also stored in the vault and kept secret even from LastPass. From easy onboarding to password autofill, which is a lifesaver, LastPass makes it easy for businesses to take control of passwords and reduce the threat of breach. And the iOS 12 and Android Oreo autofill functionality makes all of this even easier for employees to seamlessly use LastPass across mobile devices. When you open an app or visit a mobile site, the keyboard itself will offer your username and password as an autofill option. So there's one less step having to go into another app to get your password, bring it back over. You don't have to do that. It's similar to what autocorrect looks like now. So no more copying and pasting. Hey, we can all get behind that. LastPass also offers LastPass Premium for personal use, LastPass Families for your entire family. That's actually what I have at home. And LastPass Teams for teams of 50 or fewer. So check it out for yourself. I know you're going to use it and you're going to love it. I certainly do. More than 13 million people do. They trust LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager. You can learn more at lastpass.com/twit today. That's lastpass.com/twit. And see which product is right for you. And we thank LastPass for their support of Tech News Weekly. Last week was a long time ago, but thankfully a lot has happened in the world of autonomous vehicles in a single week, and who better to join me to talk about all that new news than Sam Abuel-Smid from Navigant Research. Welcome back, Sam.
Hey, Jason. It's great to be back again.
You've got a bird over your shoulder.
I do.
I don't know if you realize that.
Yeah, it's an egret that I spotted last week when I went for a walk by one of our local lakes here.
Nice. That's a great picture. So let's begin with a curious case of Elon Musk, Tesla, and the SEC. This has been a story that's been morphing and transforming pretty rapidly. Last week, the Securities and Exchange Commission announced a lawsuit being filed against Elon Musk related to his tweet where he publicly admitted to the possibility of taking Tesla private. What about the tweet was particularly actionable and of interest to the SEC to this degree?
Well, as a publicly traded company, all publicly traded companies are subject to a whole bunch of rules about how the companies publish information to everybody. Part of the goal is to make sure that no one is able to have access to insider information, about the state of a company. You don't want people trading on information that isn't available to others. And the information that is published has to actually be true, if it's material to the business. Mm-hmm. In this case, back on August 7th, Elon published a tweet saying that he wanted to take the company private at $420 a share and that he had secured funding. And that at that point, that price was about $60 or $70 a share more than the price that Tesla stock was trading at the time. And so immediately people started bidding it up. Well, if the funding actually had been secured and if it was a real offer to take the company private, that would be perfectly legitimate. But the problem is he had not secured funding, and it became pretty clear pretty soon after that tweet was published that the money was not there. No one was actually putting up the money to buy all those shares back and take the company private. And so as a result, the stock price went up. You know, people were paying more for the stock, and and then once it became clear that the privatization deal wasn't going to happen, the stock price tumbled. And so people were trading on information, material information provided by the company that was inaccurate, and that's illegal.
Provided by the CEO and then chairman of Tesla, of course, in a couple right. of, within a couple of days, Musk stepped down as chairman. We'll continue on as CEO of the company. From an operations standpoint, what exactly does that mean for Tesla? He's still CEO, and I know you've been on the show in the past and mm-hmm. and kind of talked about your thoughts on this issue, that perhaps he should be replaced as CEO with someone more effective. But what does this actually mean for how the company operates?
Well, first of all, last Thursday, right about the time you and Megan were recording the show, is when the SEC actually filed the lawsuit against mm-hmm. Elon. They started their investigation almost immediately after the initial tweet, and they filed a fraud lawsuit, a securities fraud lawsuit against Elon. And at the time, soon after that, Elon said, no, this is unjustified. It's not true. But then within 48 hours, by Saturday afternoon, they had reached a settlement where Elon agreed to pay a $20 million fine. The company paid a $20 million fine. The company is supposed to add two more independent directors to the board. And Elon is supposed to step down as chairman for a minimum of 3 years. He could keep his job as CEO. In the initial lawsuit, the SEC had actually asked for him to be barred from serving as either chairman or a director or executive of any public company, which would have been a real challenge. Stepping down as chairman, the chairman of the board, the board of directors of a public company is supposed to oversee, the actions of the executives. They are the bosses of the executives, basically, and they're supposed to represent the what's best for the shareholders of the company. Since they were not providing proper oversight over the management, the executive management of the company, particularly Elon Musk. It's why the SEC wanted to bring in more independent directors, directors who aren't associated directly with the company, who aren't employees, or who aren't, as the case of Kimball Musk, who is Elon's brother, really that closely tied to the company. I have said many times in the past that I think that if anything, Elon should step down as CEO. If he wants to stay on as chairman, chief visionary officer, fine. Because I think that's where he's actually really good at, is coming up with the big ideas and mm-hmm. providing the overall direction for the company. And that's kind of, where the chairman, the role of the chairman, should be. And then the CEO should be doing the day-to-day management of the business, executing on that overall vision. And that's where, I think Elon's great at the vision thing. He's terrible at the day-to-day management thing. He doesn't delegate to his executive team and management staff, tries to do everything himself. And no matter how brilliant somebody may be, no one person, he's still a human being, no one person can do everything, especially in a company of 35,000 employees. So I think they made a mistake in that settlement in requiring him to step down as chairman and stay as CEO. It should have been the other way around. Interestingly, just this afternoon, there's another turn in this whole thing. The judge that was overseeing the case told Tesla and the SEC that they have within the next 7 days, they have to provide a letter back to her justifying why this settlement is the right remedy for this lawsuit. Was it sufficient punishment for Elon and for the company? It's entirely possible that the judge may reject the settlement, and this may yet, end up either coming to a different settlement or maybe even going to trial if they can't come to an agreement.
Or perhaps removing, coming to a different settlement where suddenly he finds that he is no longer the CEO at Tesla. If that happened,
he could be out completely.
Yeah, if that happened, I know you wrote about kind of who you think might replace Musk at CEO more effectively. Who do you think's at the top of the list for you?
I think there's a number of really strong executives who would make really good leaders for Tesla. The top of my list, but probably one of the least likely person to take that job is John Krafcek. And, John Krafcek is currently CEO of Waymo. And back in 2013, when he was fired from Hyundai as the CEO of Hyundai of America, I suggested at that time that he should be hired at least as a COO, if not a CEO of Tesla. Since he's now with Waymo, it's unlikely that he's going to leave that job. That's a pretty plum job. It'd be hard to find a better one than that right now. But I think the other person who I think might be the best candidate to lead Tesla is Pamela Fletcher. Pamela Fletcher is currently, as of this week, she's the vice president of innovation at General Motors. For the last couple of years, she's been, over the last decade, she's been leading a lot of GM's electric vehicle efforts, including the Chevy Bolt, the Bolt EV, and most of the other electrification efforts. She led the electric powertrain development, and she's a really smart executive, really smart engineer. Understands the business, understands what it would take to run the business, and I think one of the things being a woman, I think it would be good to have a woman leading a company like Tesla, because like a lot of Silicon Valley companies, they seem to have a real bro culture, real hyper masculine culture, and I think it would probably be good for the company to bring in a high ranking woman as a leader for the company. I think it would be to Tesla's benefit to do that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, speaking of GM, you wrote yesterday, I believe it was, on Forbes about Honda's partnership with GM and Cruise Automation. What can you tell us about this?
Yeah. So, a couple of years ago, GM bought a San Francisco-based startup called Cruise Automation, who was doing autonomous vehicle software. And that group has grown and has become the core of GM's, the development team for GM's production automated vehicle software. So they're leading the development of that from their base in San Francisco. And they're also developing GM's automated ride-hailing platform that they're going to use when they start to deploy next year. Back here in Michigan, the regular GM product development team has been working on the vehicles, doing the hardware development in conjunction with the team at Cruise. A couple of months ago, GM announced an investment, $2.2 billion investment in GM Cruise LLC, which is a wholly owned subsidiary, which primarily consists of Cruise Automation, from SoftBank's Vision Fund. So they're taking a 20% stake in GM Cruise Automation. And yesterday, they announced that Honda is also investing $750 million for a 5% stake in the subsidiary. And Honda will also be working with GM on the development of a purpose-built automated vehicle for these mobility services going forward. And this is a huge boon to Honda. They've been a lot more cautious than a lot of automakers in terms of developing highly automated systems, like the type of level 4 vehicles we see from Waymo and other companies. Originally, 3 or 4 years ago, they were talking about not launching those types of vehicles until the late 2020s. 2 years ago, their CEO said, no, we're going to pull that up to 2025. Now, through this collaboration with GM, they have the potential to get something on the road as soon as probably 2021 or 2022. That is a vehicle that's specifically designed to be autonomous and to be able to be used for a wide variety of applications, like carrying passengers for ride hailing, like you do today with Lyft and Uber, or delivering packages, delivering food. So the vehicles are going to be designed to be flexible enough to be used for all these different use cases. And for GM, it's also potentially a good deal because by having Honda be a part of this, they can it'd be easier for them to start deploying this technology into some markets where GM doesn't really have much of a presence today, particularly in Japan, but also in Europe, where they pulled out last year after selling their European division to PSA. So I think it's potentially a very good deal for both sides.
Yeah, and as fast as, well, as slow of a start as Honda had, and now, you know, that timetable is accelerated, I'm guessing it's not going to be any sooner than Alphabet's Waymo driverless taxis that are apparently hitting the road in months. I didn't see this one coming. Not a test fleet either. A full-fledged driverless taxi service operating in the Phoenix, Arizona area within 3 months' time. I didn't see this coming, but then I don't follow this space as closely as you do. I felt like this kind of fully autonomous fleet was at least a couple of years down the line. Did you see this coming?
Waymo's been talking about this for some time. And in fact, you know, they, in the spring of 2017, I think June of last year, they launched what they call their early rider program. And what that was, they got people in that area, in the Chandler area, which is a suburb of Phoenix, to sign up to use Waymo's automated vehicles, their Chrysler Pacifica vans, and use them to get around, to commute. And since that time, they've had about 400 people in the area that have been using these vans to go to work, go to school, go do their shopping, whatever they need to do. And apparently the program's been fairly successful. I mean, there's been some glitches, as there is in any development program with new technology. But for the most part, the people involved, you know, that have been participating in the program seem to be quite happy. And Waymo has said for some time that they wanted to launch a commercial service that was basically open to everybody by the end of this year. And they are still saying, that they're on track to do that. I saw John Krafcek a couple of weeks ago, and he said, yeah, we're definitely on track to launch the commercial service. So that means that, just as today you can load up a Lyft app or Uber app or, depending on where you are, some other companies to get rides on your phone, you'll be able to do the same thing with a Waymo app. If you're living in the Chandler area, you'll be able to download their app, set up an account, and be able to use those vehicles to get around. And there won't be a driver. There won't be anybody sitting in the driver's seat. So these vehicles still have steering wheels and pedals in them. But they won't have somebody in the driver's seat. But at least initially, in the early part of the launch, they will have attendants. They'll have an Uber staff person in the vehicle, riding in the vehicle to answer questions and assist in any way they can. So if there's any issues, they'll be there that they can step up and take over. But they will be. The plan is for them to be driverless vehicles.
Wow, that's interesting. Would you feel comfortable relying on these as your taxi based on what you've seen?
I think it depends on where I was going and what I was doing, but yeah, I'd say probably. I've ridden in the Waymo vehicles a couple of times now, and they generally perform pretty well. They're not perfect. They have the occasional glitch, but sure. just as we human drivers do. Yeah. But yeah, they're good, and I think it would probably be fine. And knowing the people at Waymo, I'm fairly confident that they're not going to launch until they're really sure that the system is going to work really reliably, at least in the environment where they're operating. And that's the key to all this, and this is, we're going to see these vehicles, hitting the roads, in the coming months and years, but they're not going to be everywhere. They're not going to take over overnight. This is a process that's going to take many years, and even, Krafcek himself a couple of months ago, speaking at the National Governors Association, he responded to a question from a governor about, where they should be investing their money on infrastructure to support autonomous vehicles. And he said, don't worry about that. This is going to take a lot longer than you think. He said, focus on, the core infrastructure, fix your roads, your bridges, your signs and your traffic signals and everything else. And don't worry about spending a lot of money on technology right now, because it's probably going to be a long time before these vehicles get into your area. I think that's true. It's going to happen, but the timeline is going to be many years before they're everywhere.
Yep. But it all has to start somewhere. And Phoenix, yep. Phoenix is a great market to start this in. There isn't a whole lot of
weather.
Yeah, they
have perfect weather.
Yeah, they have very perfect weather. Not a whole lot.
It rains every couple of years. You know, it never snows. Right. So, yeah, I mean, it's a good market. And, you know, similarly, you know, when GM launches their service, they're still planning to launch in 2019. They're going to be launching their service in San Francisco. And it's going to be restricted to, you know, basically the city of San Francisco and maybe, you know, just the southern perimeter before, you know, slowly starts to creep outwards from there as they get more comfortable with the performance.
Yeah, I could actually see that being a very challenging market to operate it is. In. There's a whole lot of unpredictability with pedestrians and cars.
And that's
that are
one
on
of the things
road.
They've said. They said that one of the reasons why they have focused their testing on San Francisco is it's the toughest environment, one of the toughest environments you can do because it's such a complex environment. You know, if you can make it work there, you know, at least in terms of dealing with other vehicles and pedestrians and everything, then it should be able to work almost anywhere.
Yeah.
And so that's why they focus their efforts there.
Yeah, interesting. Sam Abuel-Samid, it's always great to get you on, man. Thank you so much for taking some time out today to tell us what you think about these stories. Thank you.
That's always great to be on, Jason.
NavigantResearch.com. And of course, Sam, you can find Sam's work on Forbes as well. Thanks again, Sam.
And don't forget the Wheel Bearings podcast.
That's right. Oh, I apologize. I did forget that real briefly. Tell people where they can find that.
Yeah, you can find our show. Dan Roth and I do it at wheelbearings.media. And we talk about cars and automotive technology almost every week.
Right on. Yes, definitely check it out. Thanks again, Sam. We'll talk to you soon.
All right. See you soon, Jason.
Have a good night. All right. And finally, a new study by Sanvine called the Global Internet Phenomena Report reveals some interesting insight into what exactly accounts for internet traffic worldwide. The report shows that online video accounts for 58% of all traffic online. Netflix alone accounts for 15 total percentage points on its own, which is, I think that's pretty crazy. But in recent years, file sharing, and in particular BitTorrent use, has been steadily declining, like as services like, you know, Netflix and Amazon Prime are offering reasonable monthly rates for unlimited access to content. That, in turn, was making piracy more of a pain in the neck when legitimate services are good enough. In fact, in 2011, BitTorrent was at 52.01% of upstream traffic. In 2015, that dropped to 26.83%. And in this latest report, upstream traffic, of which 97% of it was BitTorrent, dropped to 22%. But in many areas of the world, that upstream percentage is now increasing again. And, you know, as you know, with these services, exclusive content's being offered on nearly all of them. All of these major online streaming services have their own exclusive content suddenly. The marketplace finds itself fragmented again. And instead of buying subscriptions at each and every service, apparently it's becoming easier to just torrent it again, thanks to services like Kodi that make the process relatively effortless. So the industry made some excellent progress in recent years, offering reasonable priced options for all you can watch streaming, only to then reverse the trend by offering too much exclusive content, apparently. And finally, and I thought this is kind of a neat data point that kind of caps this off nicely because it totally ties in. The report had one more interesting nugget. Half of all traffic is now being encrypted, which is no surprise when you talk about all those people BitTorrenting stuff. I should also mention that BitTorrent has plenty of legitimate uses. Surely not all of that traffic is illegitimate use, but from what the study seems to point out, a good amount of it is. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv. You can subscribe to the show. All you have to do is go to twit.tv/TNW and you find all the information you need there. And if you want to tweet at me, I'm at Jason Howell. Megan Maroney will be back next week. And I also want to just throw out a thank you to the folks here from Toronto and Atlanta who are sitting in the studio watching live, making me feel all special and stuff. So thanks for you guys for coming out. If you want to join live in the studio, you can. Tickets at twit.tv. Just send an email there and we'll get you in the studio and you can make both Megan and I feel all special. And stuff. Thanks also to Josh, our TD. Thanks to Burke, Alex, everyone who helps us do the show each and every week. And thanks to you for watching. We'll see you next week on another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.